Doesn't that computer know who you
are? Don't they have any idea?
Bow down to the Tech Talk host.
That's right. That's right. That's right. That's right.
Behold the glory that is me.
A little while ago, I was installing some software, and I ran across this exact same.
I find you pompous, judgmental, and completely self-absorbed. Would you be my friend?
Onto a Windows Vista machine.
You would think.
You'd think there'd be no problem.
How could there be a problem with that?
I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
Directory permissions with config.msi directory, blah, 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 blah.
This is Tech Talk.
Good morning. This is Tech Talk, and this is Michael Kassler. Michael Tech Talk Kassler, your host for the week. You know, we got a great show today. I'm really excited about this. We've got not only Jay Garman is going to come on here in just a minute or two, and anybody that listens to the show knows that guy. JayGarman.net, of course, you can find info about him there. But also, too, coming up immediately thereafter, I have a fantastic pre-recorded interview that I did with a gentleman by the name of Samuel Arbisman. Samuel Arbisman is a fellow, well, you know what, I'm going to let him tell you who he is in the interview, but he's going to talk to us about this fantastic book that he wrote called The Half-Life of Facts, and the basic idea and concept behind it is that everything you know is wrong. Well, not yet, but it will be, and that process of us unknowing things... or of the things that we know going wrong, is not only definable, but is mathematically definable and predictable. And you can use this information to demonstrate different concepts and thoughts about how technology increases, how our knowledge base increases, and how quickly things turn over. So really kind of an interesting concept, and the book itself is absolutely fantastic. I'll give you that spoiler alert right there, is that it's a great book with a huge amount of depth, a really good one to pick up. So we're going to have Sam Arbisman on in just a minute to talk about that. Man, it has been a crazy week, though, as usual, and stuff. You know, talking about... I don't even know where to start. There's like 10 things coming off the top of my head here right now. I want to keep this local to start with. This is really a cool story that came up here in the Chicagoland area. Argonne National Laboratory has been selected as the Center for Battery Research by the Department of Energy. Now, the Department of Energy has come out and said specifically that they want achieve 5 times battery power, battery efficiency in the next 5 years. That's a power boost. That's a huge, huge jump and leap, and requires a great deal of innovation, requires a great deal of effort, and of course, a great deal of money. And with our government, that also means you've got to have a great deal of committees and groups and organizations. And hey, guess what? We're going to have a new joint center for energy storage research. That's... that's going to run us about $120 million. But I think that the results of it will be worthwhile. This is a very green type of concept and idea. And what you've got is you've got Stephen Chu. Now, Stephen Chu is the U.S. Energy Secretary, and he is modeling this effort on the same efforts that allowed us to create the atomic bomb in World War II. And if you remember that, the Manhattan Project, which was, you know, funded originally by Bell Laboratories and all this other good stuff. And those, of course, were started at the University of Chicago. And a lot of the work was done there at the University of Chicago. They are one of 5 universities that are involved in this joint project called the Battery and Energy Storage Hub Project. That's going to include University of Chicago, as I said, University of Illinois, Chicago, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, University of Michigan, and also Northwestern University. But it's kind of cool to see that involved. There are also going to be 4 private firms involved: Dow Chemicals, Applied Materials, Johnson Controls, and Clean Energy Trust. So, you know, this is just going to be a really cool thing, I think. You know, not only are we going to see battery technology evolve, no matter what. I mean, even if they don't achieve their goal, there's no doubt in my mind that with that kind of effort, that kind of brain power invested in making this occur, you're going to see a huge leap in battery technology. And we're going to see advances made that we're not even predicting right now. I do believe that the innovation that's going to come out of the universities and out of this group joint commission is going to be a really neat thing. I think another thing that we're going to see too is also possibly some advancement in areas that we won't expect. And I'm thinking specifically in areas of communication and so on. Coordinating a massive effort of this type across the country and across this many groups of people is really going to test the limits of our ability to work as organizations in a highly technical field with that barrier of distance. So you're going to see communication advances as well. I think it's going to be a really neat thing. I'm excited. I'm looking forward to coming back on in a year or two and talking about what new cool thing has come out of this. And like I said, it's going to be a lot of money, a lot of effort, a lot of people, but let's see what happens with it. And hopefully in 5 years, we will not be seeing a lot of gas-only cars because the cost and the power and the storage ability of batteries has advanced so far. So, you know, other things that are costing people a lot of money right now. Have you heard about this little thing called the Powerball? That got to be a big deal here this last week or so because it went up to one of the largest ever, $500 some odd million and all this. It turns out one individual and one couple did win and they're splitting those winnings. But in the meantime, Facebook, I don't even know what do you call this guy? Nolan Daniels goes on Facebook with a photoshopped snap of him with his Powerball ticket. And it's clearly photoshopped, as many people pointed out, because the numbers are in the wrong order, you know, all sorts of stuff. And but says, hey, I think I just won the Powerball. I'm going to give some random person $1 million. Share this pic, and you could be someone who gets it. Now, there's been over 1 million people that have shared this obviously fake pic, and I think it just... people's desire outweighs their common sense, I guess, in this case. I don't know. But at any rate, this guy has gained his 15 minutes of fame, that's for sure. And I know I'm contributing to it right here. It is kind of an interesting thing, though, anyways, to just point out how easy it is today to disseminate misinformation and to get it passed around and to get it cleared. And you know, you would have thought this thing had died back in the day when people remember those emails people used to shoot around that said, hey, if you share this with 15 people, Bill Gates is going to send you $100. I mean, you know, and you had to just bang your head against the wall and go, come on, people, how really dumb do you have to be to believe this kind of thing? And here's another example of that. And unfortunately, people are just as ridiculous as they always used to be. And, my apologies if you're one of the people that thought this had a chance. Take a quick look at things. Think about them. Consider if it makes any sense. And if you get past that barrier where you think this might have a chance and heck of being real, do a quick Google search. My favorite website, of course, is Snopes.com. But start anywhere. Just Google it and find out. And you'll find out pretty darn quickly these things just can't be true. Another big money judgment. Yahoo hit with a $2.7 billion judgment. Not in the U.S. here, but this is down in Mexico. Now this dealt with a kind of an interesting thing. They're in a breach of contract suit over a Yellow Pages listing service. And they claimed that there was a breach of contract because of their Yellow Pages listing service lost money with Yahoo, and that Yahoo had used the information improperly. Yahoo, of course, is saying, hey, this is not true. All of their claims are without merit. We're going to appeal. Blah, 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 and all this great stuff. Of course, the usual cycle goes on and on, and I think the lawyers might come out okay at the end of the day on this one. That's my guess, is the lawyers will be all right. Who knows what will happen, though. Yahoo, of course, not doing all that great in general, and they keep struggling and keep struggling, and they're managing to maintain life somehow. And this certainly won't help them if they do wind up having to pay out this large of a judgment. I now am going to waste no further time because I want to spend some time with our good friend Jay Garman. Let's see if we can get him on the air here as quickly as possible. And then, of course, we're going to dive into, as I talked about, that interview with Sam Arbuzman. I'm excited about putting that on.
Hello.
Good morning, Mr. Garman. Thank you for being available a few minutes earlier today.
Not a problem. I know you need to be rid of me pretty quickly.
Yes, unfortunately. And it's unfortunate, too, because, you know, the geek trivia question is a great one. And not only that, but it's so apropos. The one thing I have to ask you, were you ever a subscriber of Nintendo Power?
Yes, I was. In fact, I had the first issue of Nintendo Power in 1988.
Oh, wow. Well, I was never a first issue holder. I did have a subscription to it for, gosh, I think probably about a year and a half or 2 years. And kind of wish I'd held on to those. This, of course, I'm bringing this up because you may already have seen the final issue out on newsstands. December is the last issue of Nintendo Power ever.
Yeah, and what's interesting, I actually read up on that, Nintendo stopped publishing it like 5 years ago, and someone else bought the license to keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering who in 2007 is going, you know what? I want to publish a magazine about just one console. That's a winner for me.
Well, of course, I mean, 5 years ago, where was the Wii on the drawing board? Had that
come out? I think the Wii had just come out.
Yeah, so, yeah, you know, you take, I could see, yeah, but no, you're right. Because especially considering that the magazine sales in general were tanking, as was all print media, and then you've got, you know, these gaming magazines also not doing particularly well. But, yeah, their last episode is going to highlight the Wii U and some of the games that are coming out for that. And then this, I guess that's their swan song.
Well, and it's an homage cover if you've seen it. It's a 3D imaging of Super Mario Wii U, which is the exact same, like, photo inset of the original Super Mario Brothers 2 cover of Nintendo Power from 1988. So it's like 25 years later, and they're still basically making Mario game strategy guides. No wonder they're out of business.
Exactly. Although, you know, keeping the same character has done okay by the James Bond franchise and a few others, but yeah, it's a little different with the video game industry. I hadn't actually realized Nintendo Power still existed, so I have to, although it brought up some very pleasantly nostalgic memories when I heard about them leaving, I couldn't say that I was overwhelmed with sadness or anything.
No, this takes me back because I was a subscriber to Nintendo Power and the late great Game Pro magazine.
Oh yes.
And you know, this for those of us that grew up before the internet was the internet. You know, basically who were involved in gaming and computers before 1993.
Mm-hmm.
Magazines like that were indispensable. Like, no one could beat Final Fantasy without Nintendo Power.
That's
or
right.
Game Pro. Like, it just wasn't going to happen.
yep, absolutely. And yeah, and some of those copies that were being passed around at school were so dog-eared and tattered, you know, by the time that you get them, it was, and of course this is before, you know, everybody had a copier, scanner and printer in their home as well. So the one copy was the copy you had.
And the real genius of that, because, you know, some of us that had teachers for friends could, you know, get to the office copier machines, but a lot of those magazines would have, like, fold-out, like, 4 foot by 3 foot, like, platform level maps.
Oh, yeah, right.
Like, there's no way to photocopy that.
No, no, that's right, that's right. Yeah, there was a Zelda one, and also, I did remember there was an Atari 2600 magazine as well, and I don't recall what the name of it was, but it was Atari something or other. But yeah, they did the same thing in that one as well with some of the games that they had. Man, yeah. So, you know, Nintendo Power's gone, but Pong still lives on. I actually just saw my dad playing it on his Android tablet. He got a version of Pong to play, and was hilarious yesterday watching him play and then handing it over to my sons, who the graphics are the same, but they still had a lot of fun playing it. And what a different world it is. But you need to tell us about we did Pong already last week. I'm getting completely lost. What are we responding to this week? What was I supposed to be thinking about, and I've obviously clearly forgotten about?
Actually, we had a Cyber Monday employment question. What percentage of employees had been fired for shopping at work, which is important to know on Cyber Monday?
Yes, yes. How many of my listeners are potentially feeling the impact of having wasted time on Monday?
Well, according to the annual survey that CareerBuilder does, and I need to importantly point out that this is only a survey of non-government workers, so that's not the complete picture, but hiring managers in non-government positions in the United States, 7% of them have fired employees for shopping at work online.
Wow, 7%. I mean, and that's for specifically shopping at work. This isn't for just using the computer for inappropriate purposes or non-work-related purposes.
No. 25% of employers have fired people for a non-work-related internet activity, which is a very broad category of internet activity.
Yeah.
For those of us that have worked in any sort of IT capacity, I think we know where a large percentage of that was.
yes, indeed.
That cannot be spoken of on a family podcast.
Exactly.
But what's interesting is that the 7% of, and this is for holiday shopping, not shopping, holiday shopping, is 7% of employers have fired employees for doing that at work.
Wow.
Online.
Wow.
So, I mean, it's not even just shopping overall. It's just for the holidays, which I think is when most of it happens.
Yeah.
But what's interesting is that compared to other activities, 11% of these same hiring managers have fired somebody for a social media post, and 11% have also fired them for sending non-work-related emails.
Wow. That's a large, and especially sending non-work-related emails. I mean, you know, it is so tough these days with how integrated, at least for me personally, but I know, you know, for many, how integrated our work and personal lives are, to contemplate not sending. I mean, you know, I do try to keep it separated as much as you can, but there's, you know, you just got to expect there's going to be a little bit of crossover.
Well, and my suspicion is, and the survey does not go into detail, is I don't think any more employers are, you know, sensitive to you sending personal emails from a personal webmail account at work on break time, you know, during lunch and on breaks. What they don't want you doing is, you know, sending, let's say, personal romantic emails from company email addresses.
Yes, General.
Go get yourself a David Petraeus Gmail address and go do your business there.
Exactly. We don't want to go down that rabbit hole again. So what should we be thinking about for those of us that are still gainfully employed after this Cyber Monday? What should we be thinking about for this coming week?
Well, I saw the whole country go nuts over the Powerball record jackpot, so I thought I'd do something lottery-related.
Hmm.
My question is, since, you know, us being geeks, we're into math and sort of thing, and what was the first recorded lottery in history?
Oh.
And what was the format of the lottery?
Oh, wow. Interesting. No, that's a great question. man, they just lottery. The concept of lottery just seems kind of eternal to me. So that's a great question.
Hey, there's a sucker board every minute.
Exactly. Man, well, I'm interested in hearing that. I'm going to have to pull us away here now. But of course, as always, people can find out more about Jay at jaygarman.net, and you get involved with a ton of great geek and sci-fi stuff, and of course with additional podcasts. There's a lot more listening material with Jay with other properties that actually let you speak for some period of time more than we do here.
Yeah, that's why I have lower listenership than you do.
I don't know if I go that far. Hey, well, Jay, I'm gonna let you run. Thank you so much as always for coming on, and we'll look forward to hearing about lotteries next week and talking to you for some period of time.
All right, have a good one, buddy.
You too. Have a great one.
Right.
Thanks. Jay Garman, jaygarman.net. Find him there. I am going to click us over right now. We are banned. I'm going to run out of time at the end of the show here again. I'm going to click us over immediately to our interview with Sam Arbisman, author of The Half-Life of Facts. And he's coming on right now.
Foundation based in Kansas City, and I'm the author of the new book, The Half-Life of Facts, which is pretty much all about how knowledge grows, how it changes, and even how it's overturned over time. And the idea behind it is that, and we all know intuitively that knowledge is changing around us. So what we thought is nutritious now might no longer be nutritious. What we think about certain scientific facts have been overturned. So, for example, dinosaurs, what we think dinosaurs look like has changed quite a bit. We used to think they were these large, gray-green, slow-plodding reptilian monsters, and we now think that they're small and have brightly colored feathers. They look more like fearsome chickens than what we used to think. So there's all these different things that are changing around us, but it turns out beneath all this flux and all this change, there are actually regularities to how knowledge grows and changes, and it turns out you can understand these regularities through the language of mathematics.
Yeah, I thought that was such a fascinating idea when I first started reading the book, and the example that you use of a young gentleman at Raffles College and how he was forced to keep all these basically tomes of knowledge from a few hundred years before in his room and noticed this pattern emerging as he stacked them. I thought that was a fascinating anecdote.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah, so there was this guy, Derek J. DeSola Price. It was in the late 1940s. And yeah, he was just stacking books, piles of journal volumes in chronological order, and discovered that the heights of the piles, they weren't even, but they also weren't of a random height either. Instead, they actually adhered to this simple mathematical shape, in this case, exponential growth. And it turns out no one had really thought about that ever. And so he ended up writing a small paper about this and examining it in a number of different fields. And basically everyone ignored him, but he realized this was actually something fairly fundamental and very exciting. And so he began to look more and more into this and collected lots and lots of data and found that, in fact, in all areas of science and how knowledge grows, turned out there are these regularities. And he became one of the fathers of this field called scientometrics, a field that quantifies and measures how science and knowledge grows over time. And so he found everything from the number of articles and the number of journals growing exponentially to there being mathematical regularities in the growth in the number of elements in the periodic table to even the growth in the number of universities over time from the medieval period to the present day.
Now I'm a data guy at heart, so that's my background in technology is really centered a lot in data. So one thing I think might be important to note or maybe clarify for me and for the listeners would be, is there a difference between
accumulation of knowledge and collection of data. And the reason I asked that is because my first thought upon reading the dust cover for the book was, I wonder if this is applying to, you know, this really kind of prosaic collection of information like demographics, you know, and this would be an important thing to know, is how quickly is my collection of names and addresses going to go stale as I maintain it, and how much resources do I have to put into maintaining it? But I think that's a different thing, perhaps, than what you're talking about with this accumulation of knowledge.
Yeah, I'm thinking about more knowledge in terms of fact about what we think we understand about the world. So whether or not it's about our current state of understanding. So for example, the fact that we now think the Earth is round rather than flat, or what we think dinosaurs look like, but also technological facts. So our current computational abilities, or even knowledge about population. So even though, so you're right, the contacts in your address book might be going stale, but so is the number of people we think are on the planet. So the number of billions of people. So that fact, it's not that it's being overturned because we have new knowledge. It's because it's being overturned because the actual facts are changing. Mm-hmm, and so there's multiple different types of facts I discuss, broadly grouped under sort of this umbrella of what we know about the world. And the reason I group them all, even though they're different types of ways of knowing the world, is because it turns out they're often tightly intertwined and they often change in similar ways. So for example, technological knowledge change can actually have a big impact on what we know about our world in terms of our ability to measure it, but also our ability to actually gain scientific understanding. So for example, I mentioned earlier there are regularities in the number of elements in the periodic table growing. Turns out that often goes hand in hand with our increased abilities of generating large amounts of energy in particle accelerators. Mm. Because as we can harness larger amounts of energy, we can actually discover and synthesize larger and heavier chemical elements.
Yep.
So it turns out there's this nice intertwining between understanding technological change, other types of change, even population growth, and our ability to better understand the world around us.
Well, and that was another question I was going to ask too. Is you mentioned the population growth, and certainly I wonder if a case could be made that our knowledge has increased essentially at pace with our population growth, as you have more people available to understand information and to process information, that has in essence increased the amount of information that we can process and given us this key to new knowledge. And you mentioned directly, in fact, something called citizen science, which I think is sort of linked to what I'm referring to.
Yeah, and so generally, it seems to be that the larger number of people, the more knowledge, whether science or otherwise, is being created. It actually seems as if there's something called a superlinear effect. So it's not necessarily just linear, that you add twice as many people and you're going to get twice as much new knowledge. It actually grows faster than that because it's based on the connections and the collaborations of individuals. So it seems as if there's this sort of feedback process of more people, then you actually get even more knowledge being created. But beyond that, though, and of course, it's not just necessarily just add more people and suddenly we're going to learn new things. It's about it's also just the people actually have to be engaged in creating knowledge. And as you mentioned, citizen science is this new trend that actually allows that to happen. So citizen science is simply – it's the harnessing of the general population to actually allow science to happen faster and faster. So for example, this can be everything from individuals chronicling the different bird species they see in a country and conveying information to ornithologist. But it can also even be things such as figuring out how proteins fold. So it turns out that there's a team of scientists, I believe they're at Carnegie Mellon and University of Washington. They've created a computer game where people play in a game fashion to try to actually fold proteins. And it turns out these people who are having fun, they're actually folding proteins better and more accurately than the best computer programs, or at least as good as the best computer programs that we have now. Mm-hmm. So it turns out everyday people, so-called citizens, they're able to actually help do science in an unbelievable fashion. And even such and everything from identifying the types of galaxies to helping digitize old logbooks. Citizen science is really allowing this unleashing of new scientific information in a way that was never really thought possible.
Yeah, well, but I guess that begs the question, though, too. You know, are the I wonder if these citizen scientists are operating in a manner that is, you know, truly what we would consider a scientific manner, or are they just taking kind of the place of Mechanical Turks?
Right now, I think it's closer to the latter, where it's often the scientists harnessing people around them to actually allow for data collection where it can't be automated, but you don't necessarily need – where essentially a human can do things much more easily than a computer, but you don't necessarily need someone who's specialized in the scientific method. But at the same time, though, I think there are hints of citizen scientists actually acting in a scientific fashion. So there's a team of people who are running these projects. I think they're labeled under the broad rubric called the Zooniverse, where the first one was called Galaxy Zoo, where it was getting people to identify the structure and shapes of different galaxies. So they had this massive collection of data, of astronomical data, and they just needed people to pour over all the different pictures of the galaxies. But it turns out, alongside this sort of humdrum work that these scientists were sort of getting individuals to work on, it turns out many of the lay people involved in this, occasionally they would actually find things in the pictures that the scientists themselves who were running the project never could have expected. And so more recently they've actually found, I think, numerous examples of new astronomical objects that no one knew about.
And you're not referring to pictures of the Virgin Mary in the in the galaxies.
I think there's one. It's called it's a term. I believe it's in Dutch. Hanny's Verwoop. I believe. I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation quite a bit. Hmm. But it was a Dutch school teacher who discovered some object that it looks sort of like a large green cloud. And so initially I think people were not sure whether or not this was some simple nebula or maybe an error in the camera that was imaging these pictures. But it turns out it was actually a new astronomical phenomenon that no one had known about before. And it was only because these citizen scientists were actually looking at the pictures, not necessarily just doing the task assigned to them, but also looking at them with a critical eye and finding things that even the scientists themselves had not actually anticipated.
Interesting. And you bring up a number, and one of the fun things about reading through your book is that it's just really peppered with all of these examples of knowledge that we all know, you know, quote unquote, know that this is truth. But in reality, many of them have been overturned, in some cases, decades and decades ago. The health benefits of spinach was one. The existence or non-existence of a brontosaurus is another that we're both very enlightening.
Yeah, and so and actually regarding the story of spinach, that story itself even gets better. So just to get everyone up to speed, there's a great story that was I found it in the literature. I guess it began about 30 years ago in the early 1980s, where people noted that turns out that according to the story in the late 19th century. Someone had mismeasured had measured the iron content in spinach, but then actually transposed the decimal point and then made it out to be much healthier than people thought. And it turns out, and according to the story, this error had propagated for decades simply due to a typographical error. And this might have actually led to why Popeye ate spinach. Turns out, though, as the book was going to press, I discovered that someone very recently, in the past like couple of years, a professor in the UK, Mike Sutton, has actually gone through this story and actually discovered that the error itself is actually a myth. It turns out, so he actually debunked the debunk. It turns out it's this unbelievable story, and I wrote about it for Wired about this because it's unbelievable. It turns out that probably it wasn't due to a typo. there was a period in the late 19th century where they did actually have the wrong, I guess, iron content of spinach. It was I think initially people thought that maybe it was due to experimental error. Now it seems as if it was probably a confusion between measuring iron versus measuring iron oxide, and so therefore it ended up being a lot higher than it should have been. But it turns out within a decade or two, a lot of scientists actually had the correct number. They actually had the correct iron content. And so it wasn't that it had been propagating for a good fraction of a decade. And not only that, when Sutton delves further into Popeye, it turns out that Popeye himself, when he actually looked at the comics, didn't eat spinach because of its iron content, ate spinach actually because of vitamin A, it seems. So it turns out most of the facts of the story, even though there might have been some error that it propagated, it wasn't nearly as widely as we thought, and it really didn't have actually much to do with Popeye, which is unbelievable. And so when I wrote about the story, I emailed Sutton about this to let him know, and he was actually really excited because he said a lot of times, I think when he lets people know that the story, because it turned out the story for over the past 30 years, the incorrect story, has actually propagated quite widely. And a lot of people is this wonderful example of out-of-date knowledge, even though that story itself is incorrect. And a lot of people are kind of thrown by it and don't know how to deal with it, while I was sort of reveling in it. And actually, I mentioned this story in the essay, which is a professor of mine from grad school. He was once teaching a class, and he went in on a Tuesday, and he gave a lecture on a certain scientific topic. And then on Wednesday, he read a paper that actually invalidated his entire lecture. So on Thursday, he went into his class and he said, "Remember everything I taught you? It's wrong. But if that bothers you, get out of science." So we have to recognize, we have to get really excited for just this constant overturning and eventual approach to the truth of how the world really is.
Which is a really fascinating concept. I mean, I think people really have, and you also discuss this in the book too, is that people have this sort of innate desire or predisposition, at least, to maintain the beliefs that they've always held and to continue with the same understanding or paradigms as they've always had. There was terms that you use, such as cognitive bias and change blindness and things like this, that you would think, boy, that's not going to impact our scientists, though. They're above that sort of thing. But indeed, everyone in our society is impacted by these, and it makes change very difficult.
Yeah, it can be a very big problem. And scientists often, if they have a certain view of how the world works and something new comes to them and it doesn't fit that worldview, they're very likely to throw it out. Many scientists do question it and then subject it to examination. But there's a great example. It was in the 19th century. A physician, Ignaz Semmelweis, he noticed that a lot of women were dying during childbirth, and predominantly among women whose doctors were going directly from performing autopsies to delivering babies. And so he made the recommendation that maybe they should clean their hands.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed that it reduced deaths by quite a large amount. But many people persisted in ignoring him. And they ignored him because at that point, they had no sense of the germ theory of disease. The current theory of disease was the miasma theory, this idea that low-lying clouds carry sickness. And so therefore, it made no sense that they should actually clean their hands. And so since it didn't fit into the current theory, they had no reason to actually re-examine it. And so and Ignaz Semmelweis, it sounds like he eventually went mad due to people ignoring him.
Yeah, well, and of course, too, I mean, to make that clear, is that the doctors weren't just saying, oh, that doesn't make sense, I'm not going to do this change. But Semmelweis actually, I mean, with data and experimentation, proved that this simple non-cost change in the way that they operated and acted within a hospital could reduce the incident of death by 10 times, I believe the number was.
I don't remember the exact numbers. It certainly was a very large amount. But it was because the physicians didn't have the proper framework within which to assimilate this new knowledge. They weren't able to actually to change their worldviews. I think there's many stories kinds of things of science sometimes holding out, and the truth is, it doesn't often, in most cases, it's often when you delve a little bit deeper. It's not that the scientists are holding out far beyond the time they should be. It's often that they want to actually subject it to scrutiny, which is very, very good. But in the cases where their world cannot contain this new bit of information, it's very, very hard to change your mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that kind of brings, you know, I mentioned that one of my interests is in innovation. And I think that's one of the things that came up related to innovation, too, is that you have, these two types of changes that can occur where you have the one that we're talking about, or maybe this isn't what we're talking about, but there's kind of the gradual curve change that we've talked about already, these exponential curves of increasing growth. But there's also something you refer to as a phase change. And that seems more directly related to, like, you know, the truly, you know, innovative sort of changes that we see or find in technology. But that may not be the case.
So these phase transitions are essentially, and we all know about them from the world of physics, which are when materials change from one phase to another. So, for example, you take a chunk of ice and you heat it a little bit, and suddenly, at a certain point, in this case, 0 degrees Celsius, it goes from being a solid to a liquid. We don't think of that as terribly remarkable, but the idea that this continuous small change, in this case of temperature, can actually yield a drastic change is pretty surprising. And it turns out there are a lot of these rapid changes in knowledge as well. So for example, like these rapid technological changes, or going from not knowing about any planets outside the solar system to suddenly knowing about planets outside the solar system. These are really big changes. But it turns out beneath the surface, oftentimes there is a similar kind of steady temperature change. So just as changing the temperature in a steady way can allow you to go from a solid to a liquid, oftentimes changing some steady informational parameter can actually allow you to go from one state of knowledge to a completely different, in this case, very large change of state of knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so for example, with the world of planets and extrasolar planets, I'd done some research looking at trying to predict when we would discover the first potentially habitable Earth-like planet. And of course, if we discovered something like that would be a very big game changer.
Yes.
But it turns out, over time, over the past several decades, as we've been discovering new extrasolar planets, we've been getting closer and closer. We've been finding smaller and smaller planets and planets closer and closer to ones that could have liquid water. And so even though the shifts in our knowledge might be one that's very, very big, oftentimes it can be explained by smaller, steadier changes in knowledge. And I feel like the same thing can be true with technological change and innovations. Even though, so for example, the iPhone. The mm-hmm. iPhone, and even though now that we've had it for several years, we take it for granted. When it first came out, it was this unbelievable object that seemed to be from the future. So my grandfather, he just turned 95 this past summer. He's been reading science fiction since essentially the modern dawn of the genre. And when I went with him to the Apple store soon after the iPhone came out, he was playing with the iPhone and he said, "This is it. This is the thing I've been reading about in science fiction all these years." And so it seemed as if it were this drastically revolutionary object. But in fact, it actually combined pre-existing technologies in very, very clever ways. But the idea is that if we could understand what those technologies were that needed to go into the iPhone to make it so revolutionary, we could recognize that they were slowly accreting and accumulating in a regular fashion.
Yep. Yep. Well, and that's a really interesting point too. Is that as our degree of knowledge increases, certainly, you know, the famous phrase, you know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants, I think is very true in technology as it is anywhere else. I love, there's a quote that you have late in the book. I can't recall who it was from, but the basic quote was that anything that it was invented after you were born is what we consider, you know, innovative technology.
It's a fun quote. It's actually from Alan Kay. He's a computer scientist.
Okay. So, yeah, which just hits it really on the nose. And you talk to, you know, speaking, since we are a tech show, I focus a little bit here on the technology for a bit, is that, you know, talking about technology, you talk a little bit about innovation and technology, cover Moore's Law, which I think pretty much anyone listening to the show is gonna know what that is. But also, too, referred back to Christensen and, you know, how he described these sort of S-curves of innovation and how the S-curves end, you know, but if you, and so you have this non-linear curve of change in technology, but you made the point, which I wasn't aware of, that if that there's actually, if you connect the S-curves, you wind up with a broader picture, and you do wind up with a very linear-looking technological advancement graph that does clearly show this sort of building on the shoulders of giants evolution of knowledge and technology.
Yeah, so often if you're looking at the underlying function of a technology rather than the technology itself, so even though the technology might initially have this massive exponential growth and then eventually slow down, if you say, okay, what does this technology do? Does it store information? Does it allow you to make new and faster calculations? It turns out oftentimes is that initial technology slows down and it's increased ability to do whatever this function is. A new technology takes its place and then further allows that exponential growth to continue. And so you end up getting, yeah, this very smooth, rapid growth of the function independent of the underlying technologies that are allowing that functional increase to occur.
Interesting. So would you make the assertion then that there is not really such a thing as a disruptive, truly disruptive, or type of innovation in technology, that all of our technological advances and innovations are sustaining in some sense?
That's a good question. I would say, in hindsight, I think it's very easy to often say that nothing is truly game-changing, because yeah, you can always kind of trace it backwards. In the here and now, when something happens, though, it can feel very, very revolutionary. And I think there are many, many instances where a new innovation or a new idea really can come out of nowhere. So, for example, within science, there was a man by the name of George Green. He was a mathematician, mathematical physicist in the 1800s. And he created something called, they're called Green's functions, that they're unbelievably ahead of their time. In fact, I think Einstein said that they were decades ahead Green created them decades ahead of when they should have been created. The more remarkable thing is that Green really had almost no mathematical training. He was actually a miller. He worked in his father's mill. And so the question is, not only how was it so far in advance, but how did he even come up with anything, even if it had been at the right time? So I think there are occasionally examples where people will just come up with things that are so far beyond what we might have expected. But that being said, by and large, yeah, we do stand on the shoulders of giants, that knowledge is cumulative, and there is sort of this slow accretion. And so oftentimes things can allow us to jump ahead and maybe jump further than we might have expected. But in contrast, though, oftentimes when a new innovation occurs, it doesn't necessarily occur in isolation. It often occurs in bunches. So there's this idea of multiple independent discovery, where people will discover the same thing independently, or make a new innovation around the same time. So the telephone, there's the great story, and I don't know if it's apocryphal or true, but the idea that the telephone was actually attempted to be patented twice in the exact same day, and Alexander Graham Bell beat the other guy by a few hours. So yep. So there are these large number of stories of independent discovery and simultaneous innovation. That being said, not everything is simultaneous, and I think there are examples where things happen a lot faster that are much more revolutionary than we might have expected. But my sense is those are farther in the minority.
Yeah. It does seem that with knowledge, with technology, with innovation, it's almost like there's a critical mass that's reached of information or of understanding. And then once that critical mass is reached, suddenly everyone is going to be thinking up the same essential ideas. And that's how you get like the telephone. You know, it's just all of a sudden there was this base of knowledge that allowed for the creation of a telephone. And so a telephone, hence, was going to be created one way or the other.
Right, and it seemed, yeah, in the case of the telephone, it almost seemed like it had this air of inevitability with it, at least in hindsight. I'm sure the inventors were working very hard at the time.
Yeah. Now, one thing that came up, and it's fairly early in your book, but I found this also an interesting idea, too, is that, you know, we have the general idea that the difficulty of discovering new things is increasing. You know, we're no longer, the lone individual. You brought up the idea of Green being a miller, being able to come up with these things. Or I love, of course, the stories of Newton playing with, lancing his own eyeball, basically, to experiment right. with color perception. But nowadays, it seems like there's almost no point in trying to discover something new as an individual, because you have to have so many resources available to you to make a contribution.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily go that far. And it certainly seems if you take a specific discipline, by and large, it seems as if discoveries are a little bit more difficult. It might require more manpower, more money, more teamwork, more effort to actually discover new things. And one of the reasons is because when a field is new, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. People just don't know what there is in that field, and so it's very easy to come across new ideas. And as time passes, things become a little bit more difficult. That being said, though, scientific discovery is still occurring at a great rate. People are making new discoveries. Oftentimes, when people move from one field to another, they often can bring ideas from one discipline and sort of export them to another field, and that often can create and set off a whole new wave of discovery and innovation. So I would say we're certainly nowhere near the end of discoveries. In fact, the only the only example I can think of where discoveries have ended might be in sort of the rather contrived example of discovering new major internal organs within the human body. So we know about the heart and the lungs and all those kind of well-known. We've known about those for many, many years. And then, of course, as time passed, we learned about more subtle organs like the pituitary. And then in the year 1880, a man by the name of Ivar Sandstrom, he discovered the last major internal organ to be discovered. In this case, it was the parathyroid gland. And that pretty much brought to a close this long period of discovery in a very contrived discipline. But of course, that's the exception rather than the rule. It is true that discoveries are becoming more difficult, maybe on average. But I think there are still many, many instances where even in fundamental fields, you can still make discoveries. So, for example, in the field of geometry, we've known about the field of geometry for several thousand years since Euclid. And Euclid really did most of what we needed. And of course, as time passed, people did new things, but by and large, that field was kind of considered fairly done, certainly within the past several centuries. But it turned out actually in the late, or I think it was in the mid-1990s, two high school students found a new way to prove one of Euclid's theorems. And it turns out the only proof up until that point that people had known about was the one that Euclid himself provided. And then these high school students, not realizing that there was only one proof, found their own, and they found a new one. And so oftentimes, even in areas where we think we kind of know everything or any new discovery is going to be really, really hard, I think there are often instances where there are places that are ripe for new discoveries. We sometimes just don't realize it.
Yeah. Well, and that, I guess, is kind of the double-edged sword of the incredible access to information that we have today. On the one hand, it allows us to very rapidly create a base of personal knowledge so that we can build from that. But at the same time, I think it can be somewhat defeating in that we accept that the information that we do gather is, you know, the sum total of what we can get. You know, if those high school students that you just mentioned had looked online and found out that there was already a proof and that was the one proof, they may not even have bothered to continue looking and creating their own proof.
Right. And I think, yeah, as knowledge has grown exponentially, there's this double-edged sword of just being able to have everything at our fingertips, but at the same time not being able to actually effectively search it. And so often in many instances, there's knowledge that's out there, but we just can't find it because we don't know the right terms to look for it, or just that we can't be experts in all the different disciplines. So, for example, and so we now actually have to have computational aids to help us with discovering new things. So I mention an example in my book of this sort of thought experiment of, imagine in discipline A, there's some paper that says A implies B. And somewhere else in the literature, maybe in the same field, maybe in a totally different field's literature, there's another paper that says B implies C. But simply because the scientific literature is so big, there's no single individual that has read all these papers, and including those two papers, and discovered that since A implies B and B implies C, that in fact A implies C. Mm-hmm. And it turns out, there was a information scientist in the mid-80s, Don Swanson, who sort of created this idea, this thought experiment. He referred to this as undiscovered public knowledge, but he didn't leave it as a thought experiment. He decided then to actually test it, and he found many, many examples of this where there was this undiscovered public knowledge. There was knowledge out there, but it needed to be combined. But since what we know is so large, there was no single individual that had yet discovered it. So we now actually have begun creating computer programs to help us and actually aid us in further discovery and finding out new things.
Interesting. Yeah, and I know I've heard those discussions. I can't recall what the exact examples were given, but you know that how long it would take you to learn everything that was known at the time in 14th century versus how much it would take to learn everything that is known at the time, you know, even in the beginning of the 20th century compared to now, which essentially, of course, it would take many, many lifetimes to.
Oh yeah, and I've heard people say, assuming, and you can almost like say, imagine you were to declare informational bankruptcy and say you are up to date as of now. We don't worry about anything that came before us. Let's just start from now. Mm-hmm. Within a day, you'd be so far behind that you'd never have any hope of ever catching up. And so I feel like there's just so much out there. We need to actually rely on computers to learn new things and to help us to actually make sense of the world around us.
Yep. Absolutely. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you want to make sure that we talk about? And then, of course, too, I want to make sure that you tell people where they can get the book or find more information about other things that you've written or your website and things, too.
Yeah, so my book, The Half-Life of Facts, is available online on Amazon or booksellers everywhere. And if you want more information about it, you can go to halflifeoffacts.com, or to find more information about me and my other writing, you can go to arbisman.net.
Excellent. And so that you know it also, so that listeners are aware, I mean, we just like scratched the surface of a lot of the chapters and topics, but it's just a really incredibly rich text. I found there was a lot of great references to guys as diverse as Heinlein and Maubassin and Christensen and more. You know, we talked about all these some of these people only, but listeners will not be disappointed picking up the book and feeling that we had covered even a tenth of the information that was available in it.
Well, thank you very much.
That was Sam Arbisman. Fantastic book. Really a great read. As I said at the end of the pre-recorded interview there, we really barely even scratched the surface on a lot of the very cool concepts that he brought in that book. You should definitely take a look and find it and check it out and purchase it and have fun with it. It's a neat thing to read. Now, I am going to, of course, be way, way over time here, as usual happens whenever we've got good guests on. I'm going to leave you with that information from Sam Arbisman, and then also to end up today on the podcast, only song of the week is going to be Fitz Pleasure by Alt J. Great new tune I found through a friend of mine, Mark Beer, who we've had on the show a couple of times. And we'll leave you at that. Thanks for listening. Come back and listen next week. And you've been listening to Tech Talk on WRLR 98.3 LPFM in Round Lake Heights, Illinois, and this is Fitz Pleasure by Alt J.
Tra la la tra la tra la la tra la la tra la tra la la tra la la tra la tra la la tra la la tra.
In your snatch, fierce pleasure, boom, shape pleasure.
nylon thong. Beggars men the queue to be the next. Boom, J, pleasure. Deep reading and Googling every word.